Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Neil Kelly, bringing you today's Yuma Sun Daily with a look at life in and around Yuma. Our first local news story is titled, Foster Children to Receive Holiday Gifts Through Gifting Tree Program, by Matilda Carpenter, Sun Staff Writer. The holidays are a season of giving, and here in Yuma, the Arizona Department of Child Safety has partnered with Nova Home Loans to provide cheer and a sense of community to the 135 foster children in Yuma County via the Giving Tree program. The state agency collaborates with local businesses and other organizations that commit to sponsoring a minimum of 20 children. Participants receive information such as the child's name, age, gender, and a wish list of items. DCS staff then handles the logistics and delivers the gifts to the children. In Yuma County, we have 135 kids in out-of-home care, said Mary McGee of the DCS. The long-running Giving Tree program aims to support these kids who may not know what to expect for a holiday season, if they expect anything at all. But the support from the community may give them a reason to be optimistic. I'm pretty proud. We have a lot of churches and business that participate in things all year round, said McGee. Nova Home Loans is one of the biggest ones. McGee also explained that they assist with things like bunk beds and clothing for foster children. For Jennifer Humphrey of Nova Home Loans, the program hits close to home. She herself was in the foster system as a child and recalls how much it meant when she was fostered shortly before Christmas. I got to put in foster care when I was 12 years old, 2 weeks before Christmas, and so it hits me different, she said. I remember very clearly, because I was 12, just that feeling of confusion, feeling lost, uncertain, you know, scared and lonely. All those things and getting put in foster care literally 2 weeks before Christmas, where I don't know these people at all. Humphrey stated that in spite of just meeting her foster parents, they still made sure that she had gifts under the tree come Christmas, an experience that has stuck with her to the present day. Aside from gifts, Humphrey also emphasized the importance of donating luggage, explaining that for many foster kids, whatever belongings they have are carried in trash bags. Often, these children are also in need of other items. Toiletries, bunk beds, mattresses, you name it, said Humphrey, discussing the needs of Yuma's foster children. She noted that for many children in the foster care system, uncertainty and insecurity can create scars that last a lifetime. That feeling doesn't go away. That feeling, like at any given moment, I could leave and lose all of my stuff, even your pillow or your lucky blanket or your favorite T-shirt, she recalled. McGee expressed appreciation for Humphrey's hard work, along with other DCS and Nova Home Loan staff, and pointed out that Yuma's foster children may have a happy holiday season thanks for the Giving Tree program. No one's expected to do it all, but if everyone did something, it accumulates to a lot, said McGee. Learning more about the Giving Tree program at dcs.az.gov/about/volunteer/giving-tree. The next article is titled, Caballeros de Yuma donated over $112,000 to community this year, by Josh Bootson, Sun Staff Writer. The Caballeros de Yuma provided $112,410 in cash donations directly into the hands of community recipients this year. That number does not account for the tens of thousands of dollars that the Caballeros help generate for nonprofit organizations, hotels, and local restaurants through hosting their lineup of major annual events. Clint Osborne, El Presidente of the Caballeros for fiscal year 2025-26, visited the Yuma City Council on December 3rd to provide an annual report. Caballeros de Yuma was founded in 1962 by dedicated community members and business leaders with the goals of promoting and celebrating the rich and storied culture of the Yuma region. The mission was outlined in 1962 to foster and promote Yuma, to sponsor events that elevate and publicize this community, and to work in all ways to make Yuma a better place to live, Osborne said. Some current caballeros, all volunteers, have dedicated more than 50 years of service. This longevity is a testimony to the commitment, dedication, and pride our membership holds for both the organization and the Yuma community, Osborne said. The Caballeros organize and lead some of Yuma's most widely recognized events, including Midnight at the Oasis, held every March for over three decades. Midnight at the Oasis remains one of the premier classic car shows in the entire Southwest. From its humble beginnings in 1993 with only 36 cars, this event has evolved into a massive celebration, featuring over 950 classic cars, 9 live concerts, 5 packed shows, a Thursday night rally on Main Street, and a parade often exceeding 500 vehicles, Osborne said. Mayto draws between 30,000 and 50,000 annual spectators, with an estimated 60%, 80% of entrants and attendees visiting from outside the Yuma area, helping to bolster the local hospitality, restaurant, and business industries. Between 25 and 30 nonprofits have shared approximately $75,000 in charitable distributions through Mayto, benefiting themselves by selling on-site festival food, drinks, and merchandise. The 2026 Mayto is scheduled to take place on March 6th to 8th. On the morning of July 4th, the Caballeros host the annual Independence Day flag raising at Armed Services Park, honoring local heroes and paying tribute to military service members throughout the Yuma community. Commanding officers from both Yuma Proving Ground and Marine Corps Air Station Yuma have attended this event as keynote speakers in recent years. The Caballeros also host the Colorado River Crossing Balloon Festival, this year at a brand new location overlooking the river, the Pacific Avenue Athletic Complex. The event remained a great success thanks to the overwhelming community support, families, winter visitors, and balloon enthusiasts alike that came out to enjoy the spectacular morning launches, making it another memorable festival for our city, Osborne said. The Caballeros annual event to usher in the December holiday season, the Ken and Betty Borland Holiday Pageant and Tower Lighting Ceremony, draws between 1,500 and 2,500 pounds of canned food donations benefiting the Yuma Community Food Bank. The final two major events focus on physical feats of human strength and endurance. The Yuma Territorial Marathon attracts runners from across the Southwest region, Mexico, and Canada as a certified qualifying run for the Boston Marathon. This event draws nearly 500 annual participants for its marathon, half marathon, 10K race, and team relay. The Bull of the Desert Strongman competition celebrates a different kind of strength, taking the form of vehicle pulls, heavy carries, Atlas stone lifts, and other competitive heats for both men and women. The Bull of the Desert is sanctioned by USA Strongman, allowing local winners to participate in national events. Both the Territorial Marathon and Bull of the Desert are scheduled to take place on the same day this year, coming year, January 31st, 2026. We are thrilled to bring both of these exciting athletic events to the community on the same day, showcasing strength, endurance, and the spirit of our participants, Osborne said. Through its various events and scholarships, the Caballeros have donated a total of $4.2 million since the group's foundation. These events not only enrich the lives of our citizens and attract visitors from across the Southwest and beyond, they also allow us to give back to the community we proudly serve. In addition to the events, the Caballeros have awarded between $20,000 and $40,000 in annual scholarships to local students, including the $10,000 Presidential Award. The Caballeros de Yuma remain deeply committed to supporting the education of local students, Osborne said. After another successful year of events and local philanthropy, the Caballeros are excited to continue their work into 2026 and beyond. Our next article is titled, More Than 30 Businesses Donate 70 Bikes for Gadsden Students, by Matilda Carpenter, Sun Staff Writer. Families in Gadsden will receive an unexpected gift this holiday season. More than 30 local companies and businesses have generously donated bicycles and toys to support students in the Gadsden Elementary School District No. 32, helping bring joy to children and families. In total, the initiative received more than 70 bicycles, along with toys, via the Migration Education Program and Special Education Department. The gifts were raffled and distributed during each program's holiday celebrations. Governing Board Member Mark Concha spearheaded the donation effort. Our community is very fortunate to have businesses that care deeply about our students, Concha said. These gifts will brighten the lives of so many children and remind them that they are supported by an entire community that believes in them. When local businesses invest in our students, they invest in the future of our entire community, said Board President Tadeo A. De La Hoya, who serves as San Luis Vice Mayor. Their generosity helps us build stronger connections between families, schools, and the business community. These donations will bring so much happiness to our students and provide meaningful support to our programs, said District Superintendent Lizette Esparza. Acts of kindness like these remind our students that they are surrounded by a community that believes in them. The next article is titled, Infant Swim Rescue Program Returns This January, by Josh Bootson, Sun Staff Writer. In continuation of the Greater Yuma Water Safety Alliance's efforts to expand access to swim lessons and early water safety education, the City of Yuma is continuing its partnership with Infant Swimming Resource to offer early drowning prevention education and survival swim instruction for infants and young children. The next round of classes begin January 26th and stretch to March 13th, taking place from 9:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m., Monday through Friday, at one of the city's public pools. Each participating child and parent or guardian attends daily 10-minute sessions for 6 weeks. Registration is now open. Parents should email ISR instructor Kelly Sparks at Kelly, K-E-L-L-Y, dot Sparks, S-P-A-R-K-S, at infantswim.com to reserve one of 14 available spots. Spots are filled on a first-come, first-served basis. Participation is open to families across the Yuma region. City residency is not required. A standard ISR session is valued at about $855, but thanks to a partnership between the Prison Hill Liquid Foundation and the city's U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission Pool Safety Grant, Yuma families will pay just $205 per child. The $205 is split between a $100 deposit and $105 ISR registration. Families enrolling multiple children pay one $100 deposit and a $105 registration fee per child. ISR lessons are tailored to each child's development, conducted in one-on-one, personal setting by certified instructors. ISR is the safest, most effective way for children to learn survival swimming skills that lead to confidence and competence in the water, Sparks said. Infants as young as 6 months who can sit independently learn to float on their backs. Toddlers and young children up to 6 years old learn to combine swimming and floating to reach the side of a pool, effectively equipping them with the tools to save their own lives if they ever enter water without supervision. Parents also receive education on water safety and drowning prevention and may join their child in the water to practice skills together and reinforce safe habits. I'm excited that our community can once again step up to support infant self-rescue programming in Yuma County, said Recreation Manager A.J. Mosqueda. Our partnership with the Liquid Foundation is truly making waves, and it's invaluable to the families we're reaching. For more information, visit sparksswimisr.com or contact Mosqueda at 928-373-5201. We move on to state news, and the first article there is titled, The Man Accused of Killing Charlie Kirk Appears in Court for First Time as a Judge Weighs Media Access, by Hannah Schoenbaum, Associated Press. Provo, Utah, AP. The 22-year-old Utah man charged with killing Charlie Kirk made his first in-person court appearance Thursday as his attorneys pushed to further limit media access in the high-profile criminal case. A Utah judge is weighing the public's right to know details in the prosecution of Tyler Robinson against his attorney's concerns that the swarm of media attention could interfere with his right to a fair trial. Robinson's legal team and the Utah County Sheriff's Office have asked Judge Tony Graff to ban cameras in the courtroom. Prosecutors have charged Robinson with aggravated murder in the September 10th shooting of the conservative activist on the Utah Valley University campus in Orem, just a few miles north of the Provo courthouse. They plan to seek the death penalty. Robinson arrived in court with restraints on his wrists and ankles and wearing a dress shirt, tie, and slacks. He smiled at family members sitting in the front row of the courtroom, where his mother teared up and wiped her tears with a tissue. Robinson's father and brother sat next to her. The defendant had previously appeared in court via video or audio feed from jail. A coalition of national and local news organizations, including the Associated Press, is fighting to preserve media access in the case. Graff has already made allowances to protect Robinson's presumption of innocence before a trial, agreeing that the case has drawn extraordinary public attention. Graff held a closed hearing on October 24th, in which attorneys discussed Robinson's courtroom attire and security protocols. Under a subsequent ruling by the judge, Robinson is allowed to wear street clothes in court during his pretrial hearings, but must be physically restrained due to security concerns. Graff also prohibited media from filming or photographing Robinson's restraints after his attorneys argued widespread images of him shackled and in jail clothing could prejudice future jurors. Several university students who witnessed Kirk's assassination attended Thursday's hearing. Zach Reese, a Utah Valley University student and a big Charlie Kirk fan, said he had skepticism about Robinson's arrest and came to the hearing seeking answers. Reese has family in southwestern Utah, where the Robinsons are from, and said he believes they're a good family. Brigham Young University student William Brown, who said he was about 10 feet from Kirk when he was shot, said he felt overwhelmed seeing Robinson walk into the courtroom Thursday. "I witnessed a huge event, and my brain is still trying to make sense of it," Brown said. "I feel like being here helps it feel more real than surreal." Michael Judd, an attorney for the Media Coalition, has urged Graff to let the news organizations weigh in on any future requests for closed hearings or other limitations. The media presence at Utah hearings is already limited, with judges often designating one photographer and one videographer to document a hearing and share their images with other news organizations. Additional journalists can typically attend to listen and take notes, as can members of the public. Judd wrote in recent filings that an open court safeguards the integrity of the fact-finding process while fostering public confidence in judicial proceedings. Criminal cases in the U.S. have long been open to the public, which he argued is proof that trials can be conducted fairly without restricting reporters as they work to keep the public informed. Kirk's widow, Erica Kirk, has called for full transparency, saying, "We deserve to have cameras in there." Her husband was an ally of President Donald Trump, who worked to steer young voters toward conservatism. Robinson's legal team says his pretrial publicity reaches as far as the White House, with Trump announcing soon after Robinson's arrest, "With a high degree of certainty, we have him, and I hope he gets the death penalty." Attorney Kathy Nestor has raised concern that digitally altered versions of Robinson's initial court photo have spread widely, creating misinformation about the case. Some altered images show Robinson crying or having an outburst in court, which did not happen. The next article is titled, "California Cities Pay a Lot for Water. Some Agricultural Districts Get It for Free," by Rachel Becker and Natasha Uskadugui Liggett, CalMatters. California cities pay far more for water on average than districts that supply farms, with some urban water agencies shelling out more than $2,500 per acre foot of surface water, and some irrigation districts paying nothing, according to new research. A report published Thursday by researchers with the UCLA Institute of the Environment and Sustainability and advocates with the Natural Resources Defense Council shines a light on vast disparities in the price of water across California, Arizona, and Nevada. The true price of water is often hidden from consumers. A household bill may reflect suppliers' costs to build conduits and pump water from reservoirs and rivers to farms and cities. A local district may obtain water from multiple sources at different costs. Even experts have trouble deciphering how much water suppliers pay for the water itself. The research team spent a year scouring state and federal contracts, financial reports, and agency records to assemble a data set of water purchases, transfers, and contracts to acquire water from rivers and reservoirs. They compared vastly different water suppliers with different needs and geographies, purchasing water from delivery systems built at different times and paid for under different contracts. Their overarching conclusion? One of the West's most valuable resources has no consistent valuation, and sometimes costs nothing at all. It costs money to move water around, the report says, but there is no cost and no price signal for the actual water. That's a problem, the authors argue, as California and six other states in the Colorado River Basin hash out how to distribute the river's dwindling flows, pressed by federal ultimatums and dire conditions in the river's two major reservoirs. The study sounds the alarm that the price of water doesn't reflect its growing scarcity and disincentivizes conservation. We're dealing with a river system and water supply source that is in absolute crisis and is facing massive shortfalls, and yet we're still treating this as if it's an abundant, limitless resource that should be free, said Noah Garrison, Environmental Science Practicum Director at UCLA and lead author on the study. Jeffrey Mount, Senior Fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, applauded the research effort. Though he had not reviewed the report, he said complications abound, built into the California's water infrastructure itself and amplified by climate change. Moving, storing, and treating water can drive up costs and are only sometimes captured in the price. We've got to be careful about pointing our fingers and saying farmers are getting a free ride, Mount said. Still, he agreed that water is undervalued. We do not pay the full cost of water, the full social, full economic, and the full environmental costs of water. The research team investigated how much suppliers above a certain purchase threshold spend on water from rivers and reservoirs in California, Arizona, and Nevada. They found that California water suppliers pay more than double on average than what Nevada districts pay for water, and 7 times more than suppliers in Arizona. The highest costs span the coast between San Francisco and San Diego, which the researchers attributed to the cost of delivery to those regions and water transfers that drive up the price every time water changes hands. In some of those cases, it's almost a geographic penalty for California that there are larger conveyance or transport and infrastructure needs, depending on where the districts are located, Garrison said. In California, according to the authors, cities pay on average 20 times more than water suppliers for farms and about $722 per acre foot compared to $36. 1 acre foot can supply roughly 11 Californians for a year, according to the state's Department of Water Resources. 5 major agricultural suppliers paid nothing to the federal government for nearly 4 million acre feet of water, including 3 in California that receive Colorado River water. The Imperial Irrigation District, the Coachella Valley Water District, and the Palo Verde Irrigation District. Tina Anderholt-Sheeds, water manager for the Imperial Irrigation District, which receives the single largest share of Colorado River water, said the district's contract with the U.S. government does not require any payment for the water. Cities, by contrast, received less than 40,000 acre feet of water for $0. The report notes, however, that the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California, a major urban water importer, spends only 25 cents an acre foot for around 850,000 acre feet of water from the Colorado River. Bill Hassenkamp, manager of Colorado River Resources at Metropolitan, said that the true cost of this water isn't reflected in the 25 cent fee because the expense comes from moving it. By the time the Colorado River water gets to the district, he said it costs several hundred dollars. Plus, he added, the district pays for hydropower, which helps cover the costs of the dams storing the water supply. That enables us to only pay 25 cents an acre foot to the feds on the water side, because we're paying Hoover Dam costs on the power side. Much of the difference among water prices across 3 states comes down to source. Those whose supplies come from federally managed rivers, reservoirs, aqueducts, and pumps pay far less on average than those receiving water from state-managed distribution systems or via water transfers. Garrison and his team proposed adding a $50 surcharge on per acre foot of cheap federal supplies to help shore up the infrastructure against leaks and losses or pay for large-scale conservation efforts without tapping into taxpayer dollars. But growers say that would devastate farming in California. It's important to note that the value of water is priceless, said Allison Febo, general manager of Westlands Water District, which supplies San Joaquin Valley Farms. The report calculates that the district pays less than $40 per acre foot for water from the federal Central Valley Project, though the Westlands rate structure notes another $14 fee to a restoration fund. The consequences of unaffordable water can be seen through our district: fallowed fields, unemployment, decline in food production. The Imperial Irrigation District's Shields said that a surcharge would be inconsistent with their contract, difficult to implement, and unworkable for growers. It's not like farmers can just pass it on to their buyers and then have that roll down to the consumer level where it might be manageable, Shields said. The most expensive water in California, Arizona, or Nevada flows from the rivers of Northern California, down California's state-managed system of aqueducts and pumps, to the San Gorgonio Pass Water Agency in Riverside County. Total cost, according to the report, $2,870.21 per acre foot. Lance Eckhart, the agency's general manager, said he hadn't spoken to the study's authors, but that the number sounded plausible. The price tag would make sense, he said, if it included contributing to the cost for building and maintaining the 705-mile-long water delivery system, as well as for the electricity needed to pump water over mountains. Eckhart compared the water conveyance to a railroad and his water agency to a distant stop. We're at the end, so we have the most railroad track to pay for, and also the most energy costs to get it down here, he said. Because it took decades for construction of the water delivery system to reach San Gorgonio Pass, the water agency built some of those costs into local property taxes before the water even arrived, rather than into the water bills for the cities and towns they supply. As a result, its mostly municipal customers pay only $399 per acre foot, Eckhart said. You can't build it into rates if you're not going to see your first gallon for 40 years, Eckhart said. The study didn't interrogate how the wholesale price of imported water translates to residential bills. Water managers point out that cheap supplies like groundwater can help dilute the costs of pricey imported water. The Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, for instance, purchases water imported from the Colorado River and Northern California to fill gaps left by local groundwater stores, supplies from the Owens Valley, and other locally managed sources, said Marty Adams, the utility's former general manager. The Los Angeles Department of Water and Power was unable to provide an interview. Because the amount of water needed can vary from year to year, it's added as an additional charge on top of the base rate, Adams said. If you have to pay for purchased water somewhere, when you add all the numbers up, it comes out in that total, he said. The purchased water becomes the wild card all the time. We are at the conclusion of today's Yuma Sun Daily program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Neil Kelly. Thank you for tuning in today for the Yuma Sun Daily. If you missed any part of this program, you can go to our website, sunsounds.org, and listen to it on demand under broadcast info and audio. The Wall Street Journal is next on Sun Sounds of Arizona.